This is Brendan Jennings, and you're listening to Improv Nerd. Listen to all of them, not just mine, because it's the best.
That's improv, bitch. Improv, bitch.
I mean, after all, you're nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Corain, your host of Improv Nerd. Brendan Jennings is a member of Cook County Social Club. He was a member of the Second City's ETC cast, and he has the ability to make you laugh really hard. He joined us in this live episode of Improv Nerd, where we talked to him about growing up Catholic, getting his dream job, and his philosophy of improv. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, yeah, man.
You got a lot of fans out here.
I know. I paid all of these people to be here.
Okay, you were a really small kid.
Yes.
And you say on a yearly basis you would attract one lunatic that would fuck with you. Tell us about that. Tell us about one lunatic.
Yeah. Well, I was very, very small, if you could imagine that, because I'm kind of a chubby mess right now. But as a kid, I was very tiny and very thin, and I wasn't so much bullied. I'd kind of just float through school. Nobody would really notice me, but somehow I'd always get one fucking psychopath. Are we allowed to swear on this? Or
yes, we can. No.
Okay. one psychopath would always zero in on me. Like, every single year I'd have one, and like... there was one kid named Larry who, for whatever reason, like, I of course made poor fashion choices, you know, sweatpants, mullets, way past when mullets were cool. And he would endlessly find something to get me and, like, you know, choke me out every now and then, take, like, you know, loose change. I was an idiot who would carry, like, I had a backpack that was bigger than me. And I'd always, like, just put loose change in there, which would accumulate, and I'd have, like, a huge thing of change, which is, like, you know, just begging for a bully to take that from me. But my favorite one about this guy was that one day he found out my older brother turned 16 and didn't have his learner's permit yet. And for whatever reason, that was his opportunity to just, like, what's wrong with your fucking brother, man? He doesn't have his... And I'm like, it's my brother! I don't know! You know? You know, every day I'm catching it about the sweatpants or the mullet, and I'm like, you know, now this is out of my control. My brother's fucking ruining my life. But yeah, it was just always, like, up until high school, I always had just one... Well, even in high school, there was one lunatic, but... I'd always get one, and I'd always have to pray I didn't see that person. And, like, the good thing is like, those people tended to get suspended a lot.
Were you were you terrified to go to school?
I was, to an extent, because I always knew where I'd see that person during the day. Somehow I could never dodge that bullet that, like, Larry was always in my homeroom. You know, the other psychopath would always be in my lunch or something like that. And so it did make it bad to the point where, like, the Cook County guys make fun of me. Like, my biggest fear... and a show setting is to walk out on stage and, like, find out the room is filled with teenagers because I get very uptight. I still, like, my wife will laugh. Like, we live down the street from, like, a high school, and if there's a group of teens walking, I'm like, oh, God, I get real nervous. I start sweating. I'm like, I gotta go to the other side of the street. You know, I start looking at what I'm wearing. No joke, when I was an adult, I was living in Orlando, and, like, one day I'm like, oh, it's a beautiful Orlando day, and I put on a Mickey Mouse t-shirt and went to the store. I got some comics. You know, I'm a grown man now. I can wear a Mickey Mouse t-shirt.
Now, I imagine in Orlando there's like a line of people with Mickey Mouse t-shirts going to buy the newspaper.
Yeah, and so I don't feel bad. I'm like, I finally feel comfortable with myself. And that day, like, and it was like a cartoon. Like, that day, some teens had cut school. Some wily teens had cut school. And, like,
and now you're getting nervous.
Yeah, I'm nervous. I see them because I'm
sweating a little.
You can see the main one. He's in the middle. He's got, like, the girl draped over him, laughing at everything he's saying. And, like, it's like a cartoon. Two huge dudes next to him just like, yeah, man, you're the greatest. I'm like, oh, they're getting closer. No, I'm just going to stand my ground. I'm a man. It's all right. And sure enough, I walk by. Nice t-shirt. They just start bragging me. And I'm like, I can't even catch a break. I'm in. I'll never shake it. So
it's almost like you have PTS,
you know, the post-traumatic syndrome.
Yeah, it really is.
With teenagers.
It's a very small... I'm afraid what's going to happen when my kids turn teenagers, you know?
Right.
I've just always had to get in another room.
Daddy, he's not coming home tonight. until you turn 20. Then you can come back.
Yeah, yeah. And then they'll be cool.
Now, you also said you were very funny around the house and friends, but around everyone else, you were afraid to be beaten up.
Yeah.
How did you outgrow that?
It really was college. Like, I grew up in New York on Long Island, and I really do think it's different because the only thing I know is, like, in Long Island, it was like you had to kind of know your place. Like, I was a skinny doofus, so you stay back and be a skinny doofus, and you didn't want to bring any attention to yourself. You know, I didn't want to get my ass beat, so I wasn't going to be funny unless I had to be. And so, like, unless I was around my friends, I was very quiet and just didn't want to be noticed and all that stuff. And then it was like I went to Xavier University, Cincinnati, Ohio, and it's like there's like the first day a girl talked to me, I'm like, oh, well, you're not supposed to talk to me. And then it just like kind of became like, oh, like people are different in college and a little more chill. And so I just really loosened up. I started doing theater, which was cool. Like I always got better once I found a clique to hang out in. So like in high school, once I joined the cross country team, I kind of chilled out a little bit because it's like, oh, I'm around people who get me and I have at least a collection of friends. And then so in college, it was like, oh, I'm doing theater. And it just kind of blew up to where I was so confident, man. I couldn't be stopped. I turned into an asshole.
Now, you also said you came from a strict household. Give me an example of how strict your parents were. Like, what rules that you had?
We pretty much, like, we weren't allowed to, like, even have like a late curfew. Like in the summertime, like the latest we could stay out was like 9 half the time, even when we were in high school and stuff. So we weren't allowed to go out and do a lot. And it was like my mom was always one of these like, you can't have a birthday party because then we'll have to invite everybody over. You know, like she never wanted to have a lot of people. It's not like they were great parents. It was just like we didn't get to like go out and go crazy and stuff. My wife, which is funny because my parents are like pretty liberal-minded people, and my wife's family is very conservative. And like my wife Ingi's always like, oh, I was out till midnight. It was great. We had a great time. And my parents are like, be home at 9. Where were you? Like my dad would always do that classic like, oh man, we missed curfew, and like you're just like slowly turning the door. It's like, oh, it's all dark in here. Everything's fine. And then you just hear click. Where were you? Like sitting on the couch in his underwear with his black socks. But they were awesome. But other than like, we just couldn't stay out late and stuff, which is probably fine, you know, mostly. So that just meant like we had a small collection of friends who would just always hang out on our front lawn or something. You know what I mean?
Because your mom would freak out if they were in the house?
Well, yeah.
Was she like
just
that
one thing
kind of
was
mom?
Always like one of like, I just don't. She didn't want, like, she wanted peace in the house. She also wanted to know we're close, you know? Because it was, like, it was such a weird neighborhood we lived in where, like, you know, it's a great little neighborhood, but, like, a block over is, like, hell, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it was, like, she just wanted to know we were close and not doing anything stupid, which we did anyway. You know, we had till 9 o'clock to, like, steal mailboxes. We got pretty big. There was a summer we got pretty big into stealing mailboxes.
And then, did you ever get in trouble for that?
No, they never caught us. And the thing is that if my mom will always listen to this. She always finds what I'm doing. We would take them, and there was this huge tree behind our house, and we just tied them back there because, you know, like, what are we going to do with a fucking mailbox? But there was this one family. I mean, talk about bullying. You know, we were assholes. There's one family to the point we just keep taking their mailbox that they they would bring it out every morning and chain it up. Like, please don't steal this. And then one night they forgot, and we just knocked the whole thing down. I feel awful saying that, but we were young.
Did your mom know about it today? Because if I would have told my mom, she'd be like, "That never happened."
Oh, you know? No, I wonder. We might have told her, but I think if she found out now, she'd be so disappointed. So disappointed.
This is why your father and I had curfews. This is why.
Now, you also said your household, you guys never, wasn't very affectionate, and you never said, no one ever said, I love you.
Yeah, we're not a big I love you house, which is like changed in my life. With my kids, I'm endlessly I loving you to the point
where. Because you're like compensating
for
it?
Yeah, they're endlessly sick of it. Well, because you're so cute. I don't understand how. I don't understand how you can't always be like my mom always like was the most affectionate one, but our house, like our family vacations always like, oh man, that's where we had a big fight, and we always laugh about it. That's like our, all of our.
What
like,
kind of stuff would you get in a fight over?
Oh, anything. Like, you know, like the first time, like we're huge Disney nerds and we go to Disney World all the time. And like our first year there, there's always little spots where like, that's the Chinese hot dog incident. Like, it was one of those, like when you go to Disney World and you first go there, it's like, well, you got to be here from open to close. And so we're in like the Magic Kingdom at like 11 at night, and I'm like, I'm hungry. My dad's like, well, get something to eat. You're surrounded by food. Right. And he goes, there's a place right there. And it was like this weird, like, you know, every land has something strange. And it was like, for whatever reason, it was like a Chinese restaurant. And he's like, they got hot dogs. And I'm like, I don't want a Chinese hot dog. And he loses it. Well, I'm sad, I'm getting, like, he storms off. And, like, to this day, we still go there, like, every few years, and we'll walk by there, and my mom will, like, nudge me and be like, Chinese hot dog. And so the fireworks are going off in the Magic Kingdom, and everyone's smiling, and our family's sitting there like, why is Pop walking away from us? He's up in the Swiss Family Robinson treehouse, and we're down here in the rain.
So that was how you guys connected with each other.
Yeah,
right?
And it's always busting each other's balls. It's like I had roommates in college or people who lived on my wing would come down to listen to me like take a call from home, because it'd always be like, ah, well, how the fuck's Pop doing? No way, put him on the phone, shut the fuck up, you idiot. You know, a lot of F-bombs, like, it was just how we always talked to
each other. Even though your dad was really, there was a part of him who was really strict.
Yeah, they're like, I think it was just like, he wanted to get us through our teenage years, and then once we became adults, he was like, chill, you know, and so... But it would always be, humor was huge in our house. It would just always be laughing at each other to the point where, like, he always pushed it until someone just got real sad. It was like, that's just one joke too far.
In my house, my mom was always the butt of the joke. Who was the butt of the joke in your house?
My mom, to the, like, and she probably did take a lot of shit. Somebody did say it's always the mom.
Right. Well, it's because the way they react to it, don't you think?
Yeah, well, that's like, she's surrounded by four dudes, and like, we're not I love you people, so it's always like, ah, come on, mom, hurry up, you know. And she's got a ton of these Disney stories where it's always like, your father was screaming at me, I couldn't stand it. So she took a lot, and like, it would always end up with us having to like shuffle back and like be like, I'm sorry, I was just joking. And you know, we'd always take that joke a little bit too far.
Now, you ended up, after Xavier, you go to Orlando. And you perform on a regular basis doing improv.
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of stuff? Because when you think of improv back then, we don't really think of Orlando. Yeah. is the improv capital of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of stuff was going on?
They had a theater there called SAC, which was like, I guess it's like, it was the only thing in town, but it's like kind of comedy sports. It's like short form
games.
And it's very family oriented, though, so it'd be like, it wouldn't be shocking to look out and see like an 11-year-old kid sitting there and stuff like that. So that was good for me coming from college, which, as you can tell, as I've dropped 20 F-bombs in this interview already, you know, I was like dirty. So then it was like, it really cleaned me up. It taught me how to do a show every single night in front of any audience and stuff like that. So it was great. I was doing shows almost every night for like 3 years, and it really got me to a place where I was like, man, I feel pretty good doing this improv thing. But in the back of my mind, I always, always, always wanted to go to Chicago. But I was so glad I kind of went there first, because I think I came to Chicago a much better person, like, and a better performer, and ready to, like, sit in a class. Because I'm very, like, once I get there, it's like, as soon as I show up, I want to be on stage. Why am I not on stage yet? So it was amazing to, like, show up and be in a class and be like, okay, I get this. And I was a little more chill.
And I heard that, too, that when you came here, you were so obsessed about getting hired at Second City that, I mean, you were out of your mind, right?
It was, I signed up, I started taking IO and conservatory at the exact same time. And the first question I'd ask any teacher is like, how do I get hired by Second City? It drove me up the wall. I couldn't stop thinking about it. So it was starting to get in the way. Like, I wasn't paying enough attention in class and like learning enough, not that I was doing bad or being a bad performer or anything like that. It just kind of started consuming me. I get very nervous about the future. And that's something that's never changed. It's like, well, I'm here. Like, what do I do now? I moved everyone here to go work for Second City. How come I'm not working there yet? And so that was kind of getting to me. And then, like, Al Samuels was my level three teacher. And he's like, hey, man, hey, buddy, you know what? If it happens, it happens. Why not enjoy what's happening right now? And I'm like, yeah, man, yeah, because I had a lot of great things going on. It was like I had these great groups. I was doing great shows, but the whole time I'm always endlessly thinking about what's next, and it kind of got all-consuming to me.
And then, you know, you're in a great group, Cook County Social Club, also when you came here, right?
Yeah, they kind of grew over the couple years I've been here, yeah.
And, you know, because we've had Tim on. One of our first shows was with Cook County, and I'll tell you something. Your play, describe for the people that haven't seen it, what kind of style it is.
I think we are probably very fast and gamey, but we always try to do a game within. We're also highly emotional players, I think. I think our guys are all, everything we do kind of comes from emotion, despite the fact that we're playing a lot of games. That's why many Cook County scenes end with, like, guys kissing each other and stuff like that.
Because there was a video that's on YouTube called The Pitch. I think it's on the Second City Comedy Network. And Lauren, my girlfriend, looked at it and she goes, I hope I'm not ruining this. Both pair of men kiss each other. And she's like, well, why did they do that? So now we know.
That's right.
It's kind of like if we don't have an ending, we just kiss each other?
Just go for it. That is. That is the ultimate ending. Just go for it.
You know, and I was talking to Ben Caprera, who's the producer of this, about your style. Because when Cook County played, I got to tell you something. First of all, I wanted to be liked because there's a cool factor, especially with Hess and with Ratterman.
With his fancy jeans.
With his fancy jeans, yeah.
He's got, married like, Hess wears shoes that are like put together by a pin. There's no shoelace.
Right. Yeah, it's like, and here's the thing. He's married to Holly, Holly Wortel, who's just, not Holly.
Loren.
I'm thinking of someone else, who's just beautiful. They're just, I mean, they're either going to have model kids coming right out of the womb, or the ugliest kids, don't you think? You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what? Here's the other thing. This seems so unfair that they're so talented. They're both very funny and great improvisers and great actors and so good looking at the same time.
Yeah, not fucking fair, man. This is our game. The improv is the game for the chubby doofus, not the tall, good looking glass of water.
The person that didn't get picked on growing up, you know? Yeah. He picked on other people.
I hate, like, Hess walks around with that, like, oh, I didn't shave today. And it's like, oh, he's so dreamy.
Right.
You know, I look like a pederast, you know?
A pederast?
Yeah, a fondler of children.
Oh, okay.
A pedophile.
Right. A pederast. I don't know what a pederast is.
Pedophile,
yes, I know what that is. You guys, Tim wrote and Mark wrote a pilot for Comedy Central.
Yeah, Tim, Mark, and Andy Myra, who's like our behind-the-scenes friend.
Is he a good-looking kid?
You know what? Pretty good. Oh, he's got one of those big Boston mean heads.
Yeah, great.
But he's a director guy.
Okay, great. Yeah. Who cares about the director?
Yeah. They wrote a pilot, a sketch pilot for
Comedy
Central. My Man's.
Right, and it didn't get picked up.
No, but it was great.
It was great. And I saw it. You can see it on YouTube, right?
You can see their early version, which they showed to Comedy Central, which Comedy Central loved, and then they wrote a whole other one. And this other one I think might be available one day, but it's really great.
What did you learn from that?
Various sounds come out of Brendan for 15 minutes. It was an unbelievable dream to be on, like, this is a real set. Like, we had people going around, there's craft services, there's people, like a second director being screaming shut up after the first person said shut up, and you're surrounded by your best friends, and it's like, wow, man, this is unreal. But you also learn that, like, you'd assume that with the day one you show up to Chicago and you're sitting there hoping to be on a Herald team, that if somebody told you, like, hey, one day with your best friends you're going to be making a TV show, that you'd feel like, hey, the world is ours. But you quickly realize all the other stresses that go along with this might not get picked up, we're making no money off this, and so the realities of everything that came along with it is like the big learning point. But it was also amazing to do it with your friends, you know. It's like I couldn't do this without these guys here.
And you had to make a tough decision because you were at ETC, and they floated the offer of going to main stage.
Yeah, that was very recently. Over my time in ETC, I was lucky enough to get representation and all that stuff. I never really thought about going to LA, honestly. Like, I always take everything one step at a time. So when I show up to Chicago, my whole goal was Second City. And once I got it, I was like, oh, fuck, what do I do now? Because as soon as you get Second City, it's like, well, you don't get to retire here. You know,
right,
like,
because you're making, what are you making at the top? Like, yeah, $600 bucks a week?
Yeah, if less than that, I think, okay, at ETC.
But you get a discount on the cheese baskets, don't you?
Cheese basket, chicken fingers, and cheaper beers, question mark.
Okay.
I never thought about it, but then suddenly I get representation, and like, I do one pilot season on tape, which means like, you tape here in Chicago, you send it out there and hope something happens.
Which,
and
then, that just goes to a landfill.
Yeah,
nothing
and just like,
happens.
Somebody quickly throws it
right,
away, and
yeah,
you realize all that stressing you did
right,
was for nothing. And so this year, my manager was like, you should really come out, you know, and see what it's like, and I knew main stage was coming up, and I was a couple months before floated, hey, you know, we're thinking about moving you, Tim Bald, to Mary Sona. And like, main stage was my dream job. I love that room. I walk into that room, I still get a little welled up, because I mean, it's perfect. It's history.
A lot of teenagers go to those shows.
I know. I'm glad I passed. I had to pass. I just saw too many teens. So it was offered, but I also, in my brain, I'm very much a gut person. Like, I don't make a move until I'm like, yeah, this feels right. I kind of knew. I was like, I think I'm going to leave and go do a live, like, be out in L.A. for a full month, feel what it's like. Because I just had my little girl, my third kid. And I was like, I can't sit here and keep waffling about what I'm going to do. And if I'm going to live in L.A., I have to see what it's like out there. Are there school districts and all that stuff? And so I made peace with it. And then, like, out of nowhere, they're like, this could happen. I'm like, oh, shit, now I got to really think about this. So it was an agonizing decision, but I kind of was like, I'm going to go.
Do you consult other people in your decisions, or do you just go by your gut?
I talk to my wife a ton. She's, like, basically the person who chills me out on everything. She was like, you know, your gut's always been right before. And then the Cook County guys are always, like, the second people I talk to on anything like this. And then, you know, Tim Baltz and I had been doing this forever. Like, I toured 2 years with Tim. We wrote the two shows together, and we both talked about it. And, like, so through that, like, little congress of people, I was like, I'm doing the right thing. I think I'm doing the right thing, you know. And it felt like if you're leaving something that you love so much to go try something you're totally scared of, you know, maybe that makes it a little bit better. It makes you a little bit braver, you know, coming from the small skinny kid in high school who got beat up a lot to suddenly be the brave man who's like, I'm walking away from my dream job to go live in L.A. So I took the shot.
Okay, we're going to improvise now.
Is that what that little doodle
that's
do?
The thing. Yes,
I was like, man, you're underscoring this thing.
I was going to
start pulling out some tears and really get everybody crying.
If you could wait till the end to bring the tears, because we do the improv, we come back, we talk, and then some emotional something.
That's
that'd be great. So if you could hold on to the tears, that would be great. How do you want to start? You want to get a suggestion or something?
Yeah, man. Let's
okay,
do
great.
That.
Carrie, we're going to improvise, and we'll come when the lights come up. We'll get a suggestion.
Improv.
Improv is happening. Turtle doves. Trained them for 12 years.
Yeah, 12 years.
And they're finally going out.
Yeah.
I wonder what they're going to see.
I hope mine goes to Europe.
You know, we could have gone.
I know.
I was ready to go. I had my bags packed. But you always freak out.
Well, I didn't have my passport.
Passport.
Yes, I need a passport.
Passport.
Nathan. Chris.
Could have thrown. I have that friend at Southwest who would let us walk right up.
But those were the 80s. Can't do that anymore.
No, we can't. We're older now. More settled in our ways. At least you are.
I hope mine goes to Austin. Austin. They make good music there. You know me, I like the young music.
Yes, you do. You like that hip-hop and that country.
Oh. Good stuff. I just wish they were. I wish they'd combine hip-hop and country together. Get it over with. They're both so uniquely American.
Yeah.
You know? Bitches and hoes and shotguns and beers. Well, that was the time. Our little capsules tied to the little claws.
Yes. So I put a message into mine.
Me too. I hope someone writes us back.
Yes.
I hope it's not a prisoner.
Oh, God. Dirty, dirty prisoner. Oh.
That's all I need. Someone knowing where I live.
Yes. You know what they want to do? Steal our identity. That's what they do.
It's not the 80s anymore.
No.
In the 80s, you could walk around, you could scream your credit card number in the street.
You could just leave it lying on the sidewalk, and 4 hours later, you'd come back, nobody would have touched
it. Because it was a sensible time.
Yes, things were better back then.
Now everyone's got to scrounge, you got to fight.
Yes.
Bitches and hoes, shotguns and country. Yes.
But not us. We have this wonderful cabin that you made with your own bare hands.
You could have helped.
I know. My sciatica.
No, it's always something with you. I have that back brace that would have held you up.
It makes me look like a, what is that, you know?
Gollum.
Gollum, yes.
Gotta stop being scared. Especially in front of the bird. Why, if that bird was you, you know what would happen? And I don't mean to be mean. Especially on your birthday, but if that bird was you,
I'm
right now,
his ears right now.
You'd let it go, it'd land, and walk right back into its cage. My bird would go to Austin. Why? Because that's where it wants to go!
And you know what would happen? Your bird would come back 8-9 days later.
Yeah.
No phone call, no messages, no texts, anything. Then you'd show up at the door expecting me to welcome you home like nothing happened.
That's how we did it in the 80s. What do you think I'm going to do? What do you think I'm going to do? You think I'm going to find another bird, fly around in the sky with it?
No, I think you're going to leave me. Yes, when you don't come back for 7 or 8 days, I think you're going to leave me.
If I was going to leave you, I'd be working out. I'm wearing an Elf t-shirt that has a meatball stain on it. Middle of the afternoon. And boxer shorts outside. Who's going to pick me up? It's not like I'm an old couch and a college student's going to be like, come along and put me in their apartment. I'm yours.
I know you are. But sometimes I just get a little insecure. I put my bird down because it's feeding time. I made a nice little cell.
And that little tiny chair you made it to.
Yes, I did. And there's one for your bird, too.
You know,
if he's not so stubborn to join my bird.
I don't want my bird seeing how nice it is over there. As soon as you make something too nice, you don't want to leave. That's why the 80s were great.
Always the 80s.
It was the best time of our lives. We came, we went, we came. We came everywhere.
Now everything was great about the 80s.
Oh, name one.
The music.
I had a good time with it. The music's so bad, why does every drive-time station have a whole rock block of 80s music? The thing is that 90% of the music was bad, but we cherished the 10% that was great.
That's your justification for everything. It's all, Mr. Math Major, it's always 10%.
I'm a 10%er?
Yes. That's what attracted you to me.
Mr. Fluffy Bottoms. Mr. Argyle Sweater.
I would really like to go out to dinner tonight, but I can't take you looking like that. You look like a house painter.
If they won't let me sit in these, I don't want to eat there. I might let a ball fall out of these boxer shorts.
You know, I'm going to say this. I may be afraid to leave our little cabin, but you're just as much of a prisoner as I am. You don't conform.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
The English major's now writing a novel
yes.
about me.
Who still lives on disability at 35 years old? What is your name? Depression?
I get sad in office settings. I need to be outdoors. I want to work. I keep applying to the zoo where they won't take me.
Back in your cage?
I'd get a job if you wanted me to, but I'd hate it. And do we really want that happening? My mother always said I could be a doctor, but why would you want a doctor who's not 100% of it?
Do you believe the things that come out of your mouth?
I wouldn't say them if I did.
Because you know what? I would support you if you got a job. Any job. When I met you, you were so ambitious. You had so many dreams. And then 8 years later, this.
Stop it.
Yes.
Stop it.
Yes.
Stop it.
You wanted to be an accountant. Remember that? You wanted to be an accountant.
Oh. Dealing with other people's money is depressing. Can barely hold on to my own.
But now you're 35 years old, and you're like a retired person.
I'm glad you said retired.
Yes.
I thought you were going to say retarded.
People tell you the truth, you know what you do? You shut down and you become just a pouty person,
Sheriff. It's true. Ah! You are ruining your own birthday!
I totally forgot it was my birthday. Of course, you didn't get me a present again this year, right?
The world is a present.
Oh, that's right.
I get you presents on days that are not your birthday. That's the fun. That's a real surprise. You wake up in the morning on your birthday, you know you're getting something.
Going to the store and getting me paper towels is not a present.
You asked for them.
I wrote it on a grocery list.
Well, you don't give me any other hints on anything else you might like.
I left a post-it saying, tomorrow is my birthday.
Oh, where am I going to go? Run out to the store and buy another Ken Burns set? Jesus. You watch those things once, you've lost 12 years of your life. 15 discs, 5 hours each, blathering about this and that.
I'm trying to educate myself and make my life better. I haven't given up like you have. You've given up. Yes, you have. What time do you get up in the morning?
Noon.
That's not morning. When was the last time that you got dressed up and you went out and just sat at a cafe and talked to people? I'm serious. Don't walk away from me.
Sometimes the loudest trumpet is the worst one in the band. You've cut through me. Yes, I blither and blather about. I talk loud. I'm fun at parties, but I'm miserable.
I'm not going to fall for it this time.
What?
Oh, your little feel sorry for what? Yourself thing. Yeah.
I don't like studying for tests.
That was great. That was awesome. Did you have a good time?
I loved it.
Yeah. So many emotional changes in you. Where did you learn that technique?
I don't know. I think that's kind of just always how I approach scene work, is that all the best ones are always deeply rooted in two people caring a lot about each other, which is why I end up kissing so many people. If that scene went on a couple more minutes,
I was like, I thought you were very close to kissing
me. Yeah, to me, it's like we do that a lot in Cook County too. But it's always like, you know, if I'm playing a wife or something, it's like it's normal to kiss your husband goodbye. You know, so it's like stupid real life things. I try to like just make it as real as possible. I think that's the best scene.
And you know what's funny? Because as I was researching you, when you were in college, they didn't give you like the serious parts, right?
No,
they thought of you as just like you were going to play the clown,
yeah,
or
yeah,
whatever. But you really are a very good actor.
God damn it! Thank you, Jimmy.
Yes, no, it's true.
Thank you. No, that's very nice. I did try out for a play once in college that was for like the main hunky role, and the person said you were the best. You read it the best, and I was like, oh wow, why didn't I get it? And I was like, look at me. And no joke, in that show, I like wore like a little sailor outfit and looked like a goddamn clown.
But I think the really good improvisers today bring acting, and I was going to say this with Cook County is. I mean, you guys go really, really, really fast, and it's beautiful to watch. But I think you got to be really skilled at it. And what you guys do is you're also really good actors. It's not just we're playing the game of the scene. We're good actors and we play the game of the scene.
Yeah, I think you really do have to lose yourself on the emotional side of it, and you get away with so much more. I think the scene is always so much more fulfilling. You know, who knows how funny anything you say is if I didn't believe it, you know what I mean? Like, saying, like, in that scene we just did, like, I'd walk in there with a ball popped out or something, wouldn't maybe get a laugh if it was delivered, like, as somebody who just sounded like they thought about that line or something like that. You know, I really do try to always lose myself in a scene and just have whatever spew out sound real and natural.
Yeah, I hope people hear this, because I think that's really... Today, that's the most important thing, you know? It could be their stand-up, or it could be really good theater, you know? And I think improvisers, let's do really good theater, you know?
Yeah, and then, like, the laughs will just come.
Yeah. So we're going to take some questions from the audience about either something we just did or a question they might have for you.
All right,
so Carrie, let's turn the lights up, and let's, we've got some people with some questions. Yeah, right over here.
Talk a little bit about how the training differed for you at I.O. as opposed to Second City. What you took from each one of them?
Second City does a real good job of... they do teach you to how to do it their way. Improv at Second City here is you do a scene improv-wise when you're writing a show, then you tweak that scene, and eventually that becomes a written sketch. And I.O. has always been more loose... this can be a fun art form type thing, where I think like Second City definitely has an end goal for you. With your improv, I think in I.O. it was a little more just finding out that you can throw something against a wall and it necessarily may not all be art. You know what I mean? Not everything's going to be a scene idea. Second City could like take anything and make it a scene idea, which I think is real impressive.
Great. Another question right here.
I noticed you guys like added a lot of details, just every so often, just another detail. Are you always thinking one line ahead? Just what's the next thing I can add?
I try not to. I always try to just be reactionary, but like sometimes, yeah, I don't think like real people would talk about that too many, like bring up details maybe in the way we did just there. But I do feel like it was just reactionary, and it's just painting a little more, filling out that painting a little bit, you know what I mean? I think it just helps establish as you go along, if you can just lay those couple of those in there every now and then, like who we are to each other.
Right, or just, you know, specifics to the history and stuff like that, I always find really helpful.
Right.
And I always feel like a dinosaur doing that, but it was not, you know, because I'm like... Oh, no, you know, everybody's really quick now, and nobody does that, but...
Well, that's that kind of stuff, like, I think people lay out there in classes, too, where it's like, the rules of improv eventually always go out the window once you realize when you're doing a scene, because every scene changes. It's so hard to put a rule on improv, because you can't say this certain scenario should be done this way as opposed to this way. You kind of got to train your mind to see different paths of where all the scene all scenes you do can go and choose one path and ride it out. But there is that thing that they teach you early on of, like, have you established who, what, and where? And I'm like, if you're kind of at a loss, it's like, why not fill one of those in a good way?
Like, in the beginning of the scene, we knew that we, I mean, you knew the relationship. We didn't even have to speak it.
Yeah, you could tell we were somehow romantically linked, just how we looked at each other.
Right.
But then it was like holding the birds. It's like, now we have no idea where we are. But then establishing, like, why not throw in there, like, hey, a cabin that you built with your own two hands is such a beautiful gift, because now, in my mind, I see we're out in these woods somewhere where a dingy cabin has been built by an overweight 35-year-old. So I think that kind of stuff is always super important. It's like, and it's always, that's a gift you can always give yourself, because everybody gets lost in a scene, so it's not, why not, like, throw that little gem out there and help everybody else have something.
I got lost five times in that scene, at least. Did you get lost in that scene?
Never, bro.
Are you serious?
They call me the flashlight. I always know where I am. No, there's, I always feel that. I think maybe it was somewhere in there I got lost, but it was like, if you establish a strong thing like we had up top with each other, it's like, now I know where to go back to. I can just, like, I think maybe when I started pouting, it was like, okay, what do I do next? Mm-hmm. Instead, it was like, well, I'm just going to pout now and see where this takes us with, you know, between our characters. Let Jimmy, like, guide me into where I should go
next.
He
doesn't know where he's going.
But that's the thing, too. You got to remember, it's a team sport, you know. You're not doing it by yourself. So, yeah, at a certain moment, if I'm on the back wall, like, okay, I'm not really sure where the scene's going next, I'm just going to pout and, like, see where he wants to take it, you know.
So if you're lost, just pout.
Just pout.
Great. All right.
Pout, scream real loud, fall asleep.
Yeah, right back here. Sure.
Yeah, and Sky's the Limit, you and Tim have that hilarious police sketch. You guys did have that.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how that formed and, like, how that sketch evolved?
That was actually that was one of the last sketches we put in.
Can you tell us about the sketch?
The sketch is kind of like an audience participation type thing. A scene happens up top. Somebody's purse gets stolen, the audience sees this, and then Tim and I come out as, like, cartoonishly huge, like, Chicago cops with, like, the black tape mustache. And we tried to solve it with the audience's help, like, what happened, and, like, various chase scenes and all this stuff happens. It was real goofy. And that scene is actually a large potpourri of, like, five other ideas that kind of came and went. And the cop idea came from a scene I pitched early on. I wanted to do, like, a full theater scene where, like, a lot of stuff happened. It was two kids playing baseball, and they decided to imagine that they were cops, and they put on the mustaches, and, like, they have a huge car chase. We ran around the theater with, like, rolly chairs and stuff like that.
Really cartoonish.
Yeah, real cartoonish, and, like, we used our fingers to have, like, a rooftop chase and stuff like that. It was real cool, but it just never, like, we couldn't, like, get it to work. The thing about Second City is, like, eventually you got to, like, trim it down so that it's a beautiful, coherent piece that can work in a 7-minute time frame. And it just couldn't come down. And then so we also had this other large audience piece where an audience member would, like, shoot somebody in a firing line. And we just couldn't get it working consistently every single night. And then so towards the end, like, Matt Hovde, our director, and I, like, came up with an idea for something. And then it was like, oh, this thing from this other failed sketch could go really well here. And so, like, that scene has, like, five bits that were just from sketches that weren't working, and they all worked so beautifully together into this, like, brand new sketch. It was quite a feat. We put it in, like, no joke, like, 2 days before opening, and, like, we're like, I hope this works.
Do you experience that the stuff at the end is really the best stuff, usually?
Oh, yeah, because, like, to think when it really works well, too, you're so out of gas by the time this thing ends. When it starts working, it's like, oh my god, it really was, like, probably your most pure idea, because you're pulling it just out of nothing. You've got no gas left, and you're just like, what about this? And it's like because early on you overthink every single thing you pitch. It's like, oh, I hope this is funny, and you rewrite it 12 times if you come in with a written idea, or you overthink it, and if it doesn't go well in the improv, you're just like, oh, forget it, oh, let's not do it. But when you're at the end and you're just done, it's like, here's an idea. Let's try it. And, like, that's probably the best way to work.
Do you think everybody's more open to it at that point?
Yeah, because everybody's just like, if you couldn't come up with an idea, it's like, well, thank God he had one. And so everyone just jumps on it. And, like, that one just came together so beautifully, and it really worked super well. It was great.
Yes. Right here?
Did you ever like find yourself in a slump in your performance? And if so, how did you deal with it?
I go through it. I mentally think I go through a slump all the time. I think I'm in one right now. I've been gone for like 2 months, and I just did my first Cook County show on Tuesday.
Did they let you back?
They did, okay. With open arms.
Did Hester let you back?
Barely.
Okay.
He was so well dressed. And no, like, I feel real bad. I think slumps. What I discovered on Tuesday is like I put myself into a bad mental state before I even started the show. I think it really is. How you're feeling about yourself. Like, right before the show started on Tuesday, I'm like, guys, I may have a bad one. I just don't feel right. And I was like, why the fuck would I do that to myself? And sure enough, I went up there, and I just felt awful because I was like, I came into the game ready to feel awful. Like, so I do go through that a lot, and it's something that never ends. It's always a battle within yourself to be like, you know, I'm fine. Things are going to be fine. The best thing I ever learned, like, from doing this and that I wish I had when I started was that you're going to suck sometimes, and like when you think you're sucking, you're probably not even half as bad as you think you are. You know, you're eating shit, nobody's noticing except you, so just chill out and like, keep doing work, and eventually it'll just be good. If you just go back to that basic idea of like, well, let me just start connecting with somebody instead of fucking thinking about the show while I'm in it. I wish I did that Tuesday. Oh, boy.
What would you have done differently Tuesday?
Tuesday, I would have, like, from the start, not said to the group of people I'm about to go on stage with, I don't feel right. You know what I mean? Because now it's like, what am I asking him to do? Like, carry me through this show or something? It's stupid.
I'll tell you something I did once. It was a show here. It was an improv show. And I felt out of sorts. I always feel out of sorts. And it was the younger generation. And I came in and I said, you know, I feel like I'm not going to do a good show or whatever. And somebody told me, and I can't remember who it was. I want to say it was Ryan Archibald, but I could be wrong. He said, make sure that you're the first person in that scene. And I did that. I was terrified, and it really helped me.
It's great.
Do you have tricks like that?
I do. I often do one of those where I like, fuck, and I'm out there first, and I'm going to be the first one to say something. And I think that's good. I do, like... Improv is you're battling mainly against yourself the whole time, so it's like push yourself to just get out there and lose yourself. As soon as you start thinking about the show or where it should go, that's when you're always going to defeat yourself. And if you had a bad show, I can guarantee you can always go back and think about how you were thinking about the show while you're in it. Like the best Cook County shows, we don't talk about it, and we just go up, and suddenly the show happens, and it just unfolds before us, and it's like, man, that was great. Did they just pull the lights? How long did we go? And then there are ones up there where you're like, God, when the hell is he going to pull the lights? And that's when all the shit falls out, because as soon as you start thinking about it, you're not losing yourself anymore. You're like forcing callbacks. It's like, well, I guess I'll call this back again and hope the lights go out.
And the worst is when the audience, like, you know, you're there and the audience likes it. You know,
yeah.
You're like basically phoning it in or...
Oh, all the time you get one of those, like, man, that was a great show. And you're like, really? But like somebody posted something recently about that 10 things. It's like, that's something I've always had a hard time doing is accepting a compliment. Being like, okay, yeah, thank you for liking it, you know. Who cares what you thought about it? They're the ones watching it.
Because the tendency is going, oh, you should have seen it last week. It was much better.
Oh, yeah.
We were like, a little off. Like, they care.
I'm a big psycher outer of, like, someone's in the audience, you know, like a family member or, like, a weird friend. Like, I'm... you know, like a weird friend who's like always judging you or something. It's like, well, let's see what this idiot does. And like you never do a good show in front of those people because the whole time mentally I'm just like, oh, God, why couldn't they come last week when I was killing it?
Right.
And I'm thinking that while I'm in a scene and the scene is unfolded.
Or you get the opposite where you, when you start out, you say, I don't want anybody to come to my show. Do you do this?
No, I actually have been pretty good about being like,
oh, I was. I'm finally let my girlfriend come to this show at the second show we did, but I wouldn't want anybody to come. And then you'd have those killer shows, and you're like, oh, why didn't I tell them to come?
But you were here.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. You can't ever plan it. Some shows are not going to be killer. So, like, let people show up when they want to show up and just hope it's good.
How much is this improv therapy for you?
I think it has made me the person I am today. There's no way to not make that sound lame, but like the only reason I have confidence and like I talk to people and I feel good about myself is because of it. Because it was the one place as soon as I stepped on a stage where I felt
perfect. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, I'm pretty socially awkward, or I'm less socially awkward than I was, you know. I get nervous if the conversation dips and stuff like that.
How have we been doing so far?
We're doing all right.
Okay, great.
Oh, my God.
We only got a couple minutes.
Oh, where are those lights?
Right.
I feel so much better about myself. I really like myself as a person, where like for a while there, you know, as a kid or whatever, when you're a teen or young, it's just like, man, where do I fit in and all this stuff? So it really is amazing to me. And like, I can be anything I want up here. For once, I'm like, when I'm on a stage, I'm like an alpha dog, you know what I mean? As opposed to in real life, I'm hiding from teenagers walking down the street.
What? You're a father of three.
Yeah.
How do you use your improv with your kids?
I try to be as fun as possible. The funny thing is, though, is I also, they're funnier than me, because I'm like falling into my parents' role. It's like, I got to be strict on these guys. But
how do you see yourself being strict with that?
I'm very much like making sure we're following the routine and that we don't get too goofy at the dinner table, you know. I mean, they're cracking each other up, and I can't believe I'm saying, like, guys, come on, idiots! You know, and like as it's coming out of my mouth, I'm like, oh, when did I turn into this? But you then realize as a parent that if you don't stop them, they're not going to eat. So I like try to just make sure that they have fun, but realize, you know, they got to put it in there and focus the fun, you know, because I don't want them to turn into like crazy people.
Right. What's the hardest thing about being a father and also being an improviser?
Especially leaving your full-time job, it's been real rough being just loosely out there as an actor. For someone, again, I'm very anxious about what's happening next. So having no like set job that I go to every week kind of drives me a little bit crazy. And so it's like trying to find sitters is the hard. As soon as you have a kid, if anybody hasn't had a kid yet, get one, make them tonight. let's all fall in love. As soon as you have a kid, everyone, like when they first meet, goes, oh, anytime you want a sitter, you just call me. And the second you call these people, no one's available. You've got to pay money, so much money to buy a sitter. Like half the time I have to, whenever I get a job here at Second City, like a BizCo or something, I always have to go, how much does it pay? And I feel bad saying that right away. But you then have to break down every hour your kid's being watched by a babysitter and how much you get. So like I'm flying to Arizona next week and the pay is pretty good, but at the end I'm just making $50. So it makes it hard to like keep living this kind of life when you sit there and you look at your kids and be like, man, if I was just like a doctor or somebody more stable, I wouldn't endlessly be panicked about like, what do I do? Do I move to LA? Do I not move to LA? To me, that's like the hardest part about doing this and being a parent is that endless anxiousness.
Do you ever blame them? Like, I'd be farther if I didn't have these three. That's how I would be.
Actually, no. And I never have. I think they make me better at handling this. Like, they really, again, they've made me a better person. Just keep saying that cheesy line. And that, like, I think more clearly now. I just don't say yes to everything. I don't jump into something.
When you say yes, you mean projects.
Yeah, I don't say yes to anything somebody's like project-wise. Like, and I don't instantly pack up everything and move to LA because, you know, I had an audition out there or something or stupid like that. I realize now I have to think things out. I have to be more aware of what I'm doing with my money, and I also have to, like, focus on what I want to say yes to. So I like having, like, tell my agents or something like that. To me, it's not about quantity of auditions, it's about the quality of audition. I'm going to say no sometimes, you know, and it's just really focusing my priorities. And it keeps me from being lazy. I'm also, I would tend to be a person sometimes who would just be like, it will come along eventually. You know, someone's just going to walk up and hand me a Hollywood check for a movie. and instead now it's like, oh no, I got to get out there and do the work. So like I'm out there hustling all the time. I'm putting myself on tape. I'm meeting the people I'm supposed to meet. And so they really have like increased my drive big time.
And you have to make a decision about either staying here or go to L.A. What's your thoughts spending a month there this winter?
Yeah, I spent a month there in February. And the thing is, it's, oh, God damn it. It is great and it's awful. You know, it's like the opportunities out there are unreal, but it's also that whole thing of when you're sitting out there not doing any work, like, I can't justify myself just sitting in the house, like, not working. And that's the hard part. That would happen a lot out there. And, like, at least here, I know I always have, like, bizcos, or, like, I could go teach a class or do something. It's just a matter of, like, cutting the cord of Chicago and just trusting that something good will happen and go out there. And
I think you're going to have to trust your gut on that one.
Yeah. And right now my gut is still up in the air.
Okay, still up in the air?
We'll find out.
Okay. I want to thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me, man. It was awesome.
It was great. Brendan Jennings, everybody. And they can see you at Cook County Social Club at I.O. on...
Tuesday nights, 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, thanks, bro.
I feel so hip. What does Cook County say about me? I don't care what Hess says.
We wish you were the sixth member, and then Hess likes your style. I think he likes your style.
Cool. I'm down with that. Here, Hila.
Yeah!
So check that out, and I just want to thank everybody here. I want to thank Carrie on the lights, Ben Caprero, the producer, Lauren Heist, the publicist, all the great interns that we had for this run of this show. Please go check us out at on our Facebook page, which is Improv Nerd. We've got like over 1,700 likes, and I got to tell you something, it's done wonders for my self-esteem. So go home, like us, subscribe to the podcast. We got a great podcast we just put on with Key and Peele, which they were nice enough to give us some time, so check that out. We're going to have a little raffle afterwards. We're also going to have cake. Can you stay for a quick piece of cake?
Oh, man, I never say no to cake.
Okay, great. We got cake, so we'll all be out there. If you're interested in taking a class with me, I've got the workshop coming up on Sunday. I also have an Artist Low Comedy class with a performance, which starts on April 28th. You can go to jimmycorain.com for that or see me out there during the raffle. I want to thank you again. This was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One more second. That's it. Check out our podcast. And as always, remember, walk, don't run. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd. I want to thank everyone at Second City and the Training Center, my producer as always, Ben Caprero, and you for listening. If you haven't gone to our Facebook page, please, please, please like Improv Nerd. It really helps my self-esteem. For more information on me, Jimmy Corain, and my 2012 Innie Award-winning classes and workshops, go to jimmycorain.com and check out our new website. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. as he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish.
Oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my